Welcome to the AquariumMax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 124, recorded July 31st, 2012.
And this time, everyone, we thought we would kind of give you some insights into our betta breeding project.
Yes, so we thought we'd talk about, you know, what point we're at right now and what we've learned and what we've noticed. Maybe things that we wish we'd done better and things that we're glad we did the way that we did them.
Right. Maybe a mixture in some cases. Some of them are sort of in the middle. Good
just
things and bad things of specific aspects.
Observations. Observances. I don't know if that's really... Observations.
Well, the word observance does exist, of course, but it does have a different meaning. Right.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
So, where are we at with it right now?
Well, our bettas are about a week and three days old.
About a week and a half.
Yeah, a week and 3 days old. They are now all big enough to eat newly hatched brine shrimp and things like that, which has boosted their growth. Some of them are nearly, not quite, nearly the size of a newly born baby guppy. And
so
some of them are
bigger.
A little smaller. Yeah, there's some size differential going on in the group. We originally had somewhere close to 40 of them, and we lost a few as early belly sliders, meaning not ones that were caused by swallowing unhatched brine shrimp cysts or anything like that. They were just that way from the beginning, and two or three of those were, you know, trying to dart up to the surface and not, their swim bladders didn't work, and
that's what a belly slider means, right?
Basically.
They either don't have a swim bladder or it doesn't work.
It's not
properly.
Functioning properly for whatever reason. Yeah, and so you sometimes get a few of those in a spawn. I think it's fairly normal for a few of them to show up that way. And we lost a few because of that. But we have, it's hard to tell exactly how many we have because they scatter around the tank so much, but, you know, they're still probably somewhere in the 30s to high 20s left over.
So enough for the kid science projects anyways.
Yeah. And it is a very small spawn because you can get hundreds of bettas in a spawn, but we know that at least part of that is because the female was in there eating the eggs. And part of it may be the fact that this was her first spawn. She was fairly small, and it's not uncommon for many other species to have a smaller spawn the first time. I'm not sure if that's necessarily true for bettas, but it could be.
It would make sense, though. Well, how about for maybe those of us who, not those of us, I've been here the whole time, but those of you who have just joining us or haven't been following, Russ, can you explain what our bettas are like that we're breeding the parents?
Yeah, they're both have a base body color of white, and the male is a butterfly with red markings on his fins. The female is more of a Cambodia, so she has the same kind of white body with fairly iridescent scales, and then she has red fins.
Mm-hmm.
And they're more, we could talk more about their characteristics, but we'll go into that later. So there you go. That's hopefully a little introduction.
Okay.
All the babies are pretty white right now.
Well, yeah, but they don't have any color on them yet.
Right.
We don't know what they're going to be yet.
Right.
Which is actually one of our kids' science projects. He's working out the genetics to try to predict what the babies will look like. So.
Right.
So let's talk about what we did right, or at least what went well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, some things we're glad that we did. First of all, talking to Carlos, getting that interview on how to spawn Betta splendens, and listening to that interview over and over again.
Thank you, Carlos.
I'm not sure exactly how many times I listened to it, but enough that it was very helpful because I could refer back into my mind to things, oh, Carlos said this about that, and so on. So that was very helpful to be able to do. I also read up on spawning bettas on, you know, several different resources that were also very helpful, and we planned it ahead of time. As those of you who have been following have noticed, we've been talking about doing this for several months, I think, and we only just started actually doing it fairly recently, so it's always good when you're embarking upon something, you know, a spawning project, to do a little
research
and preparation first.
Planning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what else? What else did we do nicely?
Well, I'm glad that we...
Well, you did. You did most of it.
It's not just me. But we had it coincide with the kids' science project so that they can each connect. You know, they can connect a research question to this process and do their science project. I think that's good in a lot of ways. It's good for them. It's good for us because they are going to be participating in the maintenance and care of the fish, making it a little easier.
I think it makes it kind of a family project, so that was fun, mm-hmm. especially since it's summer vacation.
Yeah. And I think it was good. This is something Kelly mentioned when we were thinking about this, is that we got a backup mail.
Yeah.
That was helpful because our first mail, I don't know if it was just his aggressive style because he was, you know, a placard and maybe a little more aggressive than some others anyway, but he really scared the female to death, and she wasn't going to do anything, at least not immediately with him. And well, so the fact that we had this other male...
He didn't quite understand how to make a decent bubble nest. He needed like, beta romance 101 or something. He didn't quite get it yet.
No, and then he later built one, but it was too late by that point because the other male had already built one, so...
So maybe we'll use him a different time, because he is really pretty.
He's a very beautiful fish, yeah. Certainly is.
But he wasn't quite ready for it, so it was helpful that we had a different male to step in. One other thing that we did, we know ahead of time that we're going to need to separate the males, the babies, once they get a little bit bigger.
Yeah, we're going to need to jar them.
Yeah, so we kind of set out a call to our family and friends, saying, if you guys have any quart jars or
bigger,
bigger or whatever, you know, let us have them. So that was a helpful thing to just ask around. So you have jars ahead of time.
Yeah, well, we've had several people who have volunteered jars, so that's good. And the fact that we started doing so early is good because now we have a collection of, probably close to 15 jars.
We still need more.
We still need quite a few more, but we have a number of them already.
It's not so much scrambling when it's time to jar them.
Right. We don't have to wait. Oh, no, they're already starting to fight. Now we have to jar them. No, we need jars, so it was good to plan ahead there. Okay. Well, another thing I'd like to talk about is foods. Some good things that happen with regard to foods. I would like to thank Ryan in Mesa, Arizona again for his idea of using green beans as an infusoria food source. We used that. I was glad to try that out, and I will be using that again in the future. One thing I noticed is that the bacterial clouds that are a result after putting food in the infusoria starter, basically a tank water, happened very fast. The bloom of bacteria happened very, very fast with the green beans, faster than a lot of other foods I've used. So, some promise there. One thing, though, and I guess I can talk about this now, because it's related to this, that didn't work out as well as I would have hoped, is that I started the infusoria several days before we would need it, because most of the infusoria cultures I've used in the past didn't take any longer than that. But I think it may have been the water that I put in, the tank water.
What tank water did
you? Even though the bacterial bloom started very fast, I think I just didn't start it soon enough.
It just needed a couple extra days.
Yeah, it just needed a couple extra days. And so,
how long does an infusoria culture usually start, or usually take?
Well, I think it depends on too many factors to say. Yeah. I think it depends on how many bacteria and infusoria go into the culture when you start, the temperature, you know, the type of food you're using, all kinds of things, the quantity of food you're using, so it's hard to say. But it's usually, in the past, it just hasn't taken very long. And I don't think that's the fault at all of the green beans. I think... there were other things going on.
It happened to be that way this time.
It happened to be that way this time, probably because of the water I put in it or something. And so I should have just started a couple days earlier and everything would have been fine. But I didn't.
How long can you keep an infusoria culture going? Like, could you just start one when you put the male and the female together initially anyways, just to have it? Or would it last that long?
Yeah, you could. You might have to subculture it, but that's fine. Yeah, you can keep
it. How do you do that?
An infusoria culture going indefinitely. No, it's true. You just take some of the infusoria culture itself and add it to a different container, put more water in it, and put more food in it. Just keep going. So, yeah, you can go indefinitely. That would have been ideal. I should have started just a few days before, and I could have done that if necessary, because you can't just let an infusoria sit there unharvested. It will peak and crash. But if you subculture...
You can't just keep adding more food because they run out of space or what?
Well, they run out of something or the too many toxins build up or whatever. Mm-hmm. But if you subculture... Yeah, you just subculture it. It works fine for as long as you want to go in general, unless it gets infected by something that wipes everything out. But yeah, so that would have been good. And I will continue with the green bean culture. Once the culture started working, the green beans worked great. And even though it was a little bit later than I would have hoped. And so I will keep doing that. I'll just make sure I do it in time. So because we didn't have infusoria ready for the fish right away, I had sort of backup systems built in. I have two huge vinegar eel cultures. They're both in, I think, 2-gallon containers, something like that. Mm-hmm. And I've always got two of them. So I was able to harvest some vinegar eels and feed them. That was the fish's first meal were vinegar eels, and that worked just fine. I also had some Daphnia water. My Daphnia culture's outside. Now, one thing to bear in mind is that infusoria in Daphnia cultures exist because they eat the same sort of things the Daphnia eat, and then the Daphnia in turn eats some of the infusoria. So I had this Daphnia water, which wasn't really rich in terms of the quantity of or the density of infusoria in the water, but there were infusoria in the water. The only reason they weren't that dense is because the Daphnia were eating them. But some of the cultures that didn't have as many Daphnia yet because they were in an earlier stage, I took some of that water out and put that in the aquarium and saw that there were infusorians in it and the fish were eating it. It just wasn't as dense as I would like it to be. But that was helpful. And another thing, we have Walter worms, and newly born or newly hatched betas, at least in terms of when they're free swimming, they can also eat Walter worms. So we
had Walter worms are smaller than microworms, right?
Walter worms typically smaller than microworms, although there's a lot of confusion out there about which species is what. You know, they get confused about that. Mm-hmm. But having all of those foods was very helpful because we were able to feed the fish right away, even though the initial culture of infusoria wasn't quite ready.
Now, a lot of people start with newly hatched brine shrimp as a first food for the betas.
Right.
And we didn't do that. Why didn't we do that?
Well, that's a great question. It does work as a first food. The only thing is only a certain number of betas in any given spawn will actually be able to ingest the brine shrimp. And that works as
Why is that?
They're just not big enough You know, they're not... That's typically the reason why. They're just not big enough to swallow them. And so you'll get some of them that will be able to do it. A certain proportion of them in the spawn, they'll either rip them up or they're able to swallow because they're a little bigger or whatever. Or they're just more, they're better hunters and so they can find the smallest one, something like that. They have some ability to eat them, but that means that your spawn, you'll lose most of the fish that can't eat them.
So do people do that on purpose, just as a method of culling at the beginning?
Yeah.
The less strong ones, less vigorous?
Right, they do that, and that is can be a very good method for doing that, because then you don't have to do it. Mm-hmm. You feel bad that you're culling out these little fish. And it does result in pretty robust fish, because they are the ones who are able to do it. So it's a good way to make sure you have fairly robust fish. The issue in our case was that we had a small spawn of about 40. So you can imagine if we had only fed brine shrimp from the outset, we probably have less than 10 fish left over.
Which wouldn't be enough to do the rest of our science experiments with.
Right. We needed all the fry we could have with such a small spawn, so we opted to feed them smaller foods, and it has helped because the large majority of the fish have survived to the point where now they can eat brine shrimp without any difficulty.
That's good.
So what were we going to talk about next?
I think we were going to talk about the bubble wrap.
Oh, yes.
Carlos's ideas.
Yes. When I took these notes, I didn't put them down in any particular order, so we're talking about bubble wrap now, but that's fine.
It's okay, everybody loves bubble wrap, right? Pop, pop.
Well, Carlos was the one who suggested it to us in the interview, that you can use bubble wrap to get a fish to start building a nest under it, because it looks kind of like
looks already like a bubble nest, just really big bubbles.
Yeah, and we used that, and it worked really well. I thought it was funny and interesting how when the bubbles would form under the bubble nest, part of the nest in the middle ended up to be one big bubble. It was about an inch and a half. And I think it's in some of the pictures. Mm-hmm. This huge bubble, the his bubbles congealed, I guess, into one big bubble, and they that's persisted in the nest for quite a while. And he would take bubbles from that and add to the other parts of the nest. But at any rate, it seemed to work really well to get him to build his nest and keep the nest somewhat stable.
You know what else was interesting that we noticed, too? Even Merlin, our first male, who didn't build a whole bubble nest. He would just do little bits. He still did it under the bubble wrap. That's when we put him in the tank, that's where he went to right off.
Right.
So even though he wasn't quite ready to build a whole nest, he still recognized that, and it was still an attractive spot to him to build a nest in.
Right. And I think that is part of the reason why people do it, because they know that they can usually depend upon the fish to build a nest in the place that they choose. Because it's easier to observe it if it's in a corner in the front of the tank rather than in the back or whatever. So, and you can also choose what's under it, which you don't want anything under it, so that the bare bottom is there so that the male can collect the eggs. If it were to fall on top of a plastic plant or something, and you know,
they'd get lost.
They might get lost between the leaves. So that's another reason why that's useful. And I'm glad you remembered to point that out. That was a good thing. And we also did use the styrofoam cup over the top. This makes me recall back in the, whenever that was, when I was 13, a long time ago, and tried to spunbitus for the first time. I didn't know any of this stuff about the styrofoam cup. And so when I, would put anything, put the nest, the net in to try to catch the female, or I did use the hurricane lamp thing for the female, but when I went to pull her out, I ended up kind of messing up the nest, which may or may not have been part of the reason the male ate the eggs, but anyway. It's nice to have.
So is that what the styrofoam cup does? It kind of protects it from ripples?
It does several things. I mean, the bed egg, once again, will tend to choose an area that's covered like that. Mm-hmm. But it also does help protect against ripples, yes.
And you just, it's not the whole cup. You slice it
lengthwise
and put it over it like a pup tent.
Right. And it worked great. And we didn't take it out until the...
Did you tape it to the wall?
I did. And I think most people did.
Well, not
that.
The wall. You know, the side
the wall
of
the aquarium.
Yes.
Yeah, I did. And it seemed to work. And that's not my innovation. People do that all the time.
Okay.
So.
Well, maybe before we go on, we should take our break.
Yeah, let's do that.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Nine.
Okay, welcome back. We are still talking about our Daphnia breeding project, the things that went well.
I think you made Beta breeding project.
Did I say...
That's okay.
Did I say Daphnia?
Yeah, that's okay. We'll keep going.
I'm sorry. I was looking at the word Daphnia on our notes because we're about to talk about using Daphnia to condition the betas.
Happens all the time. When I say corn on the cob, I usually say chicken for some reason.
You can't say corn on the cob.
Except when I'm thinking about it, which I am now. But
like, if we're at the table and he wants to say, pass the corn, and it's corn on the cob, he says chicken.
Okay.
Which is neither here nor there, but it's funny.
You don't systematically replace Beta with Daphnia, which is good.
Yes, that's true.
Okay, so where were we again? We were talking about Daphnia?
Daphnia used to condition the fish.
Oh, yeah. I'm really glad we were using Daphnia to condition the adults, and they seem to really respond to it well. And even now, after they have spawned and that's finished, I just think I'm going to keep giving them a couple Daphnia every day because they love it.
It's like candy.
Seems to keep them, you know, vigorous and healthy. And so right now they're getting a diet of Addison's Beta pellets with a few Daphnia every day. It seems to work really well. It's good for their color, it seems to be, and they're happy with it. So I'm glad we had Daphnia to condition the adults. Here's an interesting thing, too. When introducing Daphnia water from my Daphnia cultures outside in an effort to give the fish some infusoria early on before the culture was mature, I put in, you know, I couldn't help introducing a few Daphnia. I guess I could have put it through a brine shrimp net or something, but I just tried to take the water from areas where there weren't that many Daphnia and caught a few. and dropped him in the tank. And I was cognizant of the fact that that would happen, but I wasn't worried about it because I've read about and heard about people putting Daphnia into their betta fry tanks, because the bettas are, the Daphnia certainly don't hurt the anything, and they help clear things out of the water. You know, they can help clear bacteria out of the water and things like that as they're just filter feeding. And then once they start giving birth, they release the juvenile Daphnia into the water, and the fry, once they're big enough, can start eating those.
They eat the baby Daphnia.
They eat the baby Daphnia.
So that's another form of food for them.
Right, and depending on which species of Daphnia you can get, some of the Daphnia release very, very small Daphnia. The species that I have...
They could eat them even sooner.
Yeah, my current belief is that I have at least three species of Daphnia in the culture that I'm doing right now. One of them's really big and releases really big baby Daphnia, so I don't think they could eat those. But some of the other species in there release, you know, smaller ones, and that would be great. I don't think they can eat them yet because they're still quite a bit bigger than newly hatched brine shrimp, but they are not that much bigger, so that maybe in another week and a half or so they might be able to eat them. So I'm glad I added them, but here's a fringe benefit that I never would have guessed, but it's kind of cool. I was noticing that Walter worms, even though they seem to stay afloat a little longer than microworms, because they're smaller, but much less time than vinegar eels.
Vinegar eels just kind of sink?
They float. No, vinegar eels float for
days. Oh, they float.
Some of them stay at the surface, and others just go around in the water column, but they stay in the water column. Walter worms...
The vinegar eels stay in the water column?
Vinegar eels do, yeah.
The vinegar eels stay in the Walter column. Sorry, I'm not sure what my problem is today.
No, but the water column, the Walter worms fall out of it pretty fast. And
okay.
So you've got all these bettas. The babies like to stay, at least ours did, like to stay near the surface of the water in the first few days. And so you put all these Walter worms in, they grab a couple, and then the rest of them sink. And so you've
got
hundreds of Walter worms sitting on the bottom of the tank, and you have to siphon them out so that they don't rot in there, because they'll survive for a couple of days in the water, but they're at the bottom, eventually they'll die, and then the fish, you know,
right. The
water goes bad and everything. So that was kind of a problem. It was really frustrating thing. This is ridiculously inefficient. I tried different things. I tried kind of smearing with a cotton swab, smearing the worms right near the surface,
mm-hmm.
and then they sort of crawl down the damp side of the glass until they drip into the tank, and that helped a little, but not that much, and tried different things. This is a funny thing I noticed. The Daphnia, would just part of their natural behavior pattern, to swim down to the bottom and sort of scrape their antennae against the bottom and then swim back up. And it seemed that what was happening is that when they'd do that, they'd grab a few worms and pull them up into the water column with them.
Like just on accident.
Yeah, just by accident. They'd adhere to them or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then they'd swim up in the water column and drop them, and they'd fall back down, and then the fish could get at them.
So they had a second chance to eat them.
Right. So the fish had a second chance to eat them, which I thought was... Well, it probably wasn't a major contributor to what the fish were ingesting, but it was interesting to observe all the same. And after a few days, the betta seemed to realize that the worms were on the bottom, and that most of them spend most of their time near there. I am a little concerned about their ventral fins now, because when they're down on the bottom a lot, they can get bacteria on the ventral fins
that
can
cause scraped.
Them to rot away. Yeah. Mm. So they end up growing up without any ventral fins.
That would be difficult.
Yes. Well, they can survive perfectly well without them, but they don't look as cool.
Well, yeah, you don't want to be missing limbs.
I know. Well, I'm just saying that the ventral fins don't contribute that much to their maneuverability, I don't think. I mean, I think they can do okay with them.
Mm-hmm.
There are probably some minor effects to their maneuverability, but the main thing is it just doesn't look as good if they're missing fins.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, you know, you can't, I don't know, you wouldn't want to
sell them to the pet store.
To subject fish to growing up without the fins, mm-hmm. even if it doesn't do all that much, even if they can survive without them. So.
Well, and we are going to try to sell some of the babies to the pet store when we're done, because we can't keep that many.
Right.
If they were missing all their ventral fins, they probably wouldn't want them.
Could be. So we will, we have been transitioning their diet over to brine shrimp, and that has already seemed to make a difference in where the fish hover. They learn fast. That they're already starting to spend more time out in the midwater again after having fed on brine shrimp. So that's another thing. Another thing that I'm glad we did is that we timed the breeding of the bettas to coincide roughly with my vacation time from work. Because I think this would have been a lot more stressful if I had been at work, just because...
You would have been worried about the baby fish at home, at, you know, when you were at work. And
well, not just that, but there's a lot of things that need to be done with the mm-hmm. fish that are fairly easy for me, but might not be as easy for you and the kids to have to deal with, because you haven't had quite as much experience with that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But although we are teaching the kids how to do it, so that when I go back to work, they'll be ready to, you know, hatch baby brine shrimp and things like that. So, and I'm also glad we set up the brine shrimp hatchery well in advance, before we even thought of feeding the fish, brine shrimp, because I had to tweak a few things to figure out how to get the brine shrimp hatchery to produce the right amount of shrimp for such a small spawn. You know, if we had had 200 fish, we would have had to produce a lot more. And in some ways, producing a lot of brine shrimp is easier than producing a smaller number in terms of harvesting and things like that. So trying to work that out for a few days. And then I can always feed the brine shrimp to other fish. That's not that much of a problem. But, you know, trying to get it to work out was took a few days to tweak it. And now it's at a good point where I can produce just enough to feed the fish and not really have that many left over. And I'm glad we did that. Just doing things in advance is always good. So I guess that would just about wrap it up. Is there any other things that we've noticed or would like to...
As far as for what worked?
What worked, yeah.
I think that's everything.
Okay.
We can go on to what we would do differently.
Okay. Well, a few things we would have done differently. One thing, from one standpoint, it really would have been nice. We were originally considering, and I think we talked about this on the podcast, doing some opaque whites, placots, half moon placots. Would have been really nice to do that. Or any really, you get some really high quality fish. And the fish we have are nice, but they're not...
They were just from the pet store.
Yeah, they were from the pet store, which you don't necessarily want to spawn fish from the pet store in a lot of cases, and we're aware of problems involved with that. But we had to balance it with our time limit, the money, and with the fact that our son really wanted to look into better genetics. And if we had gotten a pair from, you know, online from that are already of the same strain, he wouldn't have been able to look into that as much. Mm-hmm. So we were balancing several factors. But someday I would like to spawn, you know, get a really nice quality imported pair or a pair from a breeder, mm-hmm. something like that, and breed that. But this this was good in some ways, just because it fit in with our son's project and so on, so that's okay. But I do have some regrets there. Now, in some ways, I also wish we would have caught the female before she had eaten the eggs.
Yeah, because the male, he was just so gentle.
Yeah, that he didn't mind her hanging around the nest, and whenever an egg fell, she took advantage of it, apparently. I mean, I saw her eat two before we were able to get her out of the tank once we realized they had spawned, but I'm certain she ate more than that. So
it probably been nice. Would have been a slightly bigger spawn.
Yeah, it would have been nice to catch her earlier, but we did what we could. If we had just kept her in the glass cylinder, except when we tried to spawn them, that might have been... You know, that might have been helpful. And I know some breeders do that. And just, you know, if they don't spawn now, okay, we'll put them back in and wait. Mm-hmm. And there's that. And then other breeders say, no, you got to leave them together for a while. I know Cautilus mentioned that he had left them together for sometimes up to a week. And I hope I'm not misquoting him here, but I think he mentioned that he has had them together for up to a week. Certain bettas that are just really calm. Mm-hmm. And they exist together very platonically, I think were his words. And then he has to separate them and try again. And that's kind of what ours were seeming to do, except for the female was gradually getting more interested. At first she was just not sure what was going on. Mm-hmm. She was interested but not participatory. And then she was getting more and more interested gradually, and then suddenly we realized that they had spawned. So, you know, that happens. But I kind of wish we had just caught her right as soon as they had finished spawning. And, of course, I should have started the infusoria earlier.
Which we talked about.
Yeah, which we did talk about. And so those are just a few things. There are probably some others, too, that I'll think of as time goes on. But it's been a lot of fun, and we've gotten some footage. So if
we'll put that all together.
Yeah, we'll eventually put it together as kind of a spawning journal. But hopefully you've already gone on to last week's episode, episode 123, or you've gone to our Facebook page and seen the male taking care of some of the babies and a close-up of one of the babies the first day it became free swimming. Kind of fun to see.
There was one today. We went to go get the camera, but he moved already before we got back. But it was really cute because they're just so small still, and you can see their little black dots for their eyes. And he was sitting just right in front of the glass, hovering there, looking straight out at us. And it was like, he's just looking out on the world, you know.
Yeah, one funny thing
that was funny.
How much they act like betas, even though they don't really look like them yet. They look like, you know, any egg layer fry, pretty much, at this point. They don't have the characteristic beta shapes. But they already move their bodies like betas. And they already act with little beta personalities, which is kind of fun. And one thing I noticed that's really interesting, and others have commented on this, is that beta fry don't move nearly as much as a lot of other fry. Like, of all the fish that I've bred, including live bears, different cichlids, different egg scatterers, like white clouds or danios or whatever, they just seem to move more than the betas do, in the, at least in the early days. I mean, we haven't been with this spawn for very long, but, you know, white clouds or rainbow fish, whatever, they're zipping around the tank looking for food almost all the time, moving around. The betas, at least, especially in the first couple of days, would just pick a spot and sit there. And sit there and not even eat anything unless it came within a couple of millimeters of their face. And then they would eat, which made it really hard when you're trying to spread worms around the tank in front of them. Even today, they're moving more now, but even today I had this one that was sitting in a corner all by himself when I was putting brine shrimp
He's
in.
He's feeling lonely.
And he wasn't eating. And so I took an eyedropper and shot, you know, about 20 brine shrimp over his way, and he just perked up and was slurping them up. But I had to shoot him in front of his face before he would do that. they just seem to sit still a lot more.
Wait for it to come to them.
Yeah, wait for their ambush predators more so than a lot of the other fish that I've seen. So it's interesting to see that difference. So, anyway, I think that's about the show for today.
I think so.
So, we'll keep you updated on our betas. Please, don't hesitate to write or send us a voice message or, you know, post something on Facebook, whatever. And we will talk to you next time.
May the fish
be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629. Or email us at info@aquarimax.com.